This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is the director. He's at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we'll be spending some time exploring the culture of Islamic Africa. And our guest for the program is Alan Roberts. He is director of the African Studies Center and professor in the Department of World Arts and Cultures at UCLA. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk that connects to an exhibition that's now available for viewing at the Cranard Art Museum, A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal is what it's called. And I had the chance to go over and to walk around and see some of the work yesterday, and it's very, very interesting. This is artwork that comes from Urban Senegal that was inspired by the Sufi mystic Amadou Bamba, a man who emphasized pacifism and the sanctity of work in his teachings, and his followers continued to work along those paths. It is interesting in and of itself because it's very striking and beautiful work, but also interesting, I'm sure, that he would say, because it one of the things that it has to tell us is that there are many different kinds of Islam and Islamic mm-hmm. practice, and we certainly shouldn't feel that the one view that often we end up with that comes through media, it's not the only Islam that exists. And so that is indeed another reason to look at and to think about this art. He will be giving a talk dealing with some of these themes. This is in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4:30, and this will be taking place, I believe, at the Cranard Art Museum. So all of these events are always open to the public and free, and anybody who is interested can stop by and hear what he has to say. And then the artwork will be on display through the end of the year. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, there will be many opportunities for you to stop by and see it. And also in December, maybe I'll also mention the fact that his co-curator of this exhibit, Dr. Mary Neuter Roberts, will be here also. And one of the artists will be here, Yelimane Fall, who does really interesting stuff with calligraphy in his artwork. It's just mm-hmm. stuff really knocks me out. Mm-hmm. And some of that is on display there. So he will actually be here to take part in this colloquium in early December. So that's another thing that if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you might be able to be involved in. And as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a real pleasure to be in Champaign-Urbana. This is a place where I've been many times in the past, and I've actually also worked with the Cranard in the past. So it's a real pleasure to be back here because I have friends and actually have family here in the area, and I'm a sort of Midwestern transplant. I lived in the Midwest for about 30 years. I didn't grow up here, but I did spend the earlier part of my career in Ann Arbor and Iowa City. And so I know Champaign-Urbana and the University of Illinois quite well.
Good, very good. Well, we're glad to have you here. Perhaps the place to start would be for me to ask you to talk about Amadou Bamba and who he was.
Amadou Bamba is a very, very interesting person. He lived from 1853 till 1927. And he was a Sufi holy man. Sufism is the mystical kind of undercurrent of Islam. It's not really separate from other Islam. All Muslims have an opportunity to move into the kinds of awareness and the forms of knowledge that constitute Sufism. Some people do it more explicitly than others, but it's really the heart of Islam, as some people say. And Bamba lived in a particularly important time in terms of the history of West Africa. He came to prominence just as the French were colonizing their portions of West Africa, right at the end of a kind of pre-colonial political economy that was based on kind of exploitative and extractive politics that also included participation in the transatlantic slave trade. So he was a young man just as there was very, very significant social change in West Africa. His messages of tolerance, religious tolerance, political tolerance, the sanctification of hard work, couldn't have been more appropriate for the particular time when people just had to shift gears and think about who they were in different ways, with the French coming in and imposing their view of the world and what they wanted Senegalese to become. He was a leader that just was absolutely crucial for that moment. The thing that's interesting also is that he is specifically an African leader of Islam, and so it's just important to understand the prominence of a particular person who comes from Africa but has messages still to share that would be quite similar to the messages for which we really revere people like Martin Luther King or Gandhi. He really could be put, or the Dalai Lama, he could be put into a category of somebody who was just very aware of the need to get down to work and to just respect other people.
Mm-hmm. There is one known photograph of this man. Mm-hmm. It's there reproduced maybe about half life size, I think, in the exhibition. And I'm sure people can find it. If you're sitting in front of your computer now, you can go to Wikipedia and you can look it up and you can see it. And it's very, very striking, otherworldly. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to describe. It was taken in 1913. And it shows him standing in front of the camera, standing against a kind of a rough wood plank building, which I guess was a mosque.
Yes.
He was in front
mm-hmm.
of. And he is wearing a white robe, and he has a kind of a long scarf draped around his head, and one part of it is going across his face, and it's covering his mouth. Mm-hmm. So what you see his forehead, his eyes, his nose. That's all of his face that you can see. And
right.
It was apparently a very bright day. It must have been very, very sunny. And he looks almost kind of like he's squinting a little bit, as if the sun is in his eyes, which gives him a very intense look. And his eyes are kind of shadowed. One eye that you really can't see, right. It's shadowed. Another you can. And it's a very, very stark, dramatic image. And you may want to say some more about this. But what is interesting, what you see in the exhibition, and apparently what you see as you go around Senegal, or at least in Dakar, mm-hmm. is various reproductions of this image. They're all over the place.
All over the place. Yep. Yeah, it's a very interesting photograph. It is the only known photograph of Amadou Bamba. And it's just very interesting in a lot of different ways. First of all, as you say, because it is produced over and over and over in all different kinds of media, from wall paintings to reverse glass paintings to plaster plaques to little pendants with the image on it or whatever. And so you do just see the image constantly. It's interesting, therefore, with regard to how people of the Sufi movement following the writings and life lessons of Amadou Bamba, who are called Murids, it's interesting to see how they use the image. But it's also very interesting in terms of a kind of intellectual focus and set of opportunities for reconsidering what we in the West know of photography, because we have a tendency to think that photography is a kind of self-evident form of reproduction, and it isn't. The things that we take for granted about photography and truth and what theorists would call indexicality, which is that the split second that the shutter is open, it captures a moment of truth. None of that is anything but cultural construction. So when you look at the way people understand this photograph in Senegal in ways very, very differently from how the same photograph would be understood in the United States, it just is a great opportunity to challenge our own ideas about photography and how it is that images are produced.
Mm-hmm.
So the oddity is that it is such a mystical and mysterious image. It was taken, as David says, in very, very contrasty, hot, sunny conditions. And that includes also the way the negative, which has now been lost, but the negative was printed. So the darkroom work exaggerates further the contrasty nature of the kind of peculiar negative. So what you get then is that the man's face is mostly characterized by what you don't see. You can't really see the features very well. One of the questions is, why was the photograph taken in the first place? It was taken in 1913 while Sheikh Amadou Bamba was held in house arrest by the French after sending him into exile two different times out of Senegal because they felt that his charisma and the degree to which he was attracting people in this kind of very turbulent time of social change, that his attraction was somehow subversive to their purposes, because they wanted everyone to follow their ideas and instructions. So they sent him out of the country. That didn't work. It only increased his attraction. They brought him back after the second exile and put him under house arrest for the rest of his life. So this photograph taken in 1913, one can only suppose was taken by the French as a kind of mugshot, a sort of surveillance photograph. And yet, if that's the case, they really blew it, because you can hardly tell who the guy is. Yeah. So, you know, it opens itself to interpretation immediately. And where Senegalese mystical Muslims share a kind of perspective on the world with other Muslims and actually other people that participate in mysticism, if you were to look at other movements in Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, wherever there's a kind of mystical approach to the world, you'd find a lot of commonalities with how Senegalese would approach this photograph. Because if you can't see the features, there's a reason for that. And if the features look like writing, as they do in his countenance, then that's because God writes the faces of people. And if, for instance, you were to see the photograph, it was such a sunny day, and the photograph has been developed in such a contrasty way that the saint is throwing a shadow on the sand next to him that obscures his right foot. And so from our perspective, we could give an explanation like I just did. Oh, well, that's because the shadow is obscuring his right foot. If he didn't have a right foot, he wouldn't be able to stand like that without falling over. Senegalese can tell you a rational explanation just like that, but that's not the point. If his foot isn't visible, where is it? And so the image itself, all the peculiarities that we could certainly notice ourselves, are opportunities for meaning-making. And so if his foot isn't there, where is it? And so that then provides a link to stories about how he had a kind of mystical communion with God. And so the photograph proves that he's stepping back from divinity into our world, bringing God's blessings to people. Mm-hmm. So there's what one author, David Morgan, calls visual piety. The image itself provides opportunities for the religion to be organized and practiced in a particular way.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting, very haunting picture. You really have to see it, I think, to appreciate yeah. these. He's also, the sleeves of the robe that he's wearing are very long. They're so long they're covering his hands.
Right.
So you can't see his hands.
Right.
You can't see his right foot.
Mm-hmm.
His features are sort of obscured.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, one thing that has been pointed out about this picture, this is not a great piece of analysis on my part, but the background
yeah.
is so sharp and distinct. It's these it's clap like rough wood clabbered
right.
siding on this building. It's almost as if you can pick out the grain mm-hmm. in the background, and yet he is this. It's he's there and he's not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really very very striking.
No, it's very strange,
project.
And I think there's a way that you could say that you know, the sort of ephemeral quality of his white robe is probably because the sunlight is so bright on it and it reflects the light and whatever. It's also quite possible that the photographer slightly misfocused the camera and that the focal point is perhaps just slightly behind the subject, which would mean that the wall is in exquisite detail, whereas you lose a lot of the detail in the figure. The thing is that Bamba is wearing a robe that was of the fashion, was fashionable in his times. And so the fact that you can't see his hands are because that's the way people wore their robes at that point. But they don't wear robes like that anymore. That's an old-fashioned kind of clothing. And so people make up, see a different explanation. And one of the things they say is, well, you can't see his hands because hands are used in everyday life. Hands are necessary to eating. Hands are necessary to work. He didn't have to eat because he was, a saint. The term that we translate as saint is from Arabic, borrowed into the local language Wolof, which is Wali Allah, which means someone who has come into proximity with God, a friend or companion. So if he is different from the rest of us, he's different because he doesn't need his hands. And if the sort of scarf turban over his face obscures his mouth, it's not that he's trying to hide himself. That's actually a fashion from the desert. Senegal is very close to the Sahara. Just keep the sand out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, it also means that whatever his speech was indirect, because it is something that is basically mitigated by the scarf in front of his mouth. So all of the things that an ordinary person would do and reveal and just make plain are not present in Bamba's image, because he is this very special person that transcended human limitations.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Alan Roberts. He's professor in the Department of World Arts and Cultures at UCLA. He's also director of the African Studies Center. He's here visiting the campus to talk about the subject, and it is definitely, as I said, in connection with an exhibition at the Crinard Art Museum. And we'll be there throughout the end of the year looking at some of the arts of urban Senegal inspired by the teachings of this man that we've been talking about here, this Muslim Sufi saint, Sheikh Amadou Bamba. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. His image, I would talk about the fact that you would see his image and various kinds of reproductions of this photograph. You see it all over the place.
All over.
It's used, people would have it in their houses, mm-hmm. but also businesses use it. It might be on the side of a building. Mm-hmm. There are some things in the exhibition that are a whole vast collection of different images, different mm-hmm. sizes, basically mm-hmm. all the same thing. Yeah. What would be for someone who was a Mourid? What would be the significance of having the image? What would be the power mm-hmm. of having that image? Either wearing it around your neck or having it on your wall at your house or having it on the wall at your place of business?
It's that the image is an active presence. So we could use the word that comes to us more from Eastern Orthodox Christianity, icon. It's mm-hmm. that when the image is somewhere, it's that the saint himself is there. So if your listeners happen to know about, for instance, the way images of the Virgin of Guadalupe are used by Chicano and Mexican people, it's that they want the image in their circumstances because they want to be blessed by, in the case of the Virgin of Guadalupe, by the Mother of Christ. And in this case, for Amadou Bamba, it's that he is actively blessing them. So that's, again, where the idea of the photograph proving that he steps back into our world to bring blessings from God, that is something that people want on their person. So they wear images because they want the blessing to be as close to them as they possibly can get. They want it to be in their places of work so that it protects them from the kinds of accidents that can happen in hard work, but also that it promotes their business, so it brings people to come and buy things or to interact in a kind of business way. They want it in their homes. We've had many people say that they have the image in their bedroom because they want it to be the last thing that they see when they go to sleep and the first thing when they wake up. So it's very similar. In the Midwest, for instance, a lot of Protestant people would have something quite similar, although the analogy might not be so apparent to people. People who have the image of the head of Christ by Warner Salmon, that is the best known image of Jesus. And people have it in their homes and churches and whatever. and will feel that having it there somehow is a good thing. It's not just that it's a declaration of your interest in Christianity and Jesus, but that Jesus is there for you. Mm. So there's a very similar kind of, kind of interaction with the presence of the saint and therefore the blessings that he brings to people from God that they want as close to themselves as they can get.
One thing that perhaps people might know about Islam, although it's not an complete absolute, and that is this injunction to show living things in art. There are mostly, although I know there are some places where there are exceptions, but mostly in Islam, you don't have portraits. People do not have, most Muslims would not have a picture of Muhammad on their wall. Maybe in Iran they might. Mm-hmm. There might be some other places, but there is this idea, and that's why in a lot of Islamic art, it's non-representational.
That's right.
Fabulous decorative arts, but you don't see pictures of people. You don't see pictures of animals.
Right.
The idea is that that's something only God can create living things, and that if you do that, you're stepping over the line between
right.
you and God.
Right.
Here, the rule seems to be broken. we have the man's portrait, and it's reproduced widely. And apparently, so these folks seem to have no problem with that idea.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting area because on the one hand, you're perfectly correct that there's a kind of, it's hard to choose the word, but anxiety or antipathy toward images of living beings that Muslims actually share. Islam comes from both Christianity and Judaism. So these are Abrahamic religions, and Jews have the same sense of not wanting to have imagery in a very active way. Mm-hmm. So this is just a kind of, continuation of that sense. On the other hand, if you were to look at any given Muslim culture, and you mentioned Iran, if we were to say, okay, what does it mean to have images in contemporary Islam? And if you were then to look at any given newspaper that shows a photograph of something going on in Tehran, for instance, you'll almost always see huge photographs blown up on walls and buildings and whatever of religious figures, Khomeini for starters, but other people as well. So, there's a kind of two-way street here because on the one hand, there actually is not a single word in the Quran, the messages that were given to the Prophet Muhammad by God. There's not a word at all in those messages about images pro or con. And in the past, there have been many traditions in Islamic art where actually even the Prophet has been portrayed in Persian miniatures and other in India and other places. So what happens is that there's a kind of secondary or tertiary writing that people interpret the messages of God, and this is true in Judaism and Christianity as well, toward a kind of antipathy to images. But at the same time, there's what one author, David Friedberg, says, the will to image. People need to see things. And so while they might be saying, oh, we don't do that, actually, if you were to say, well, so if you don't have images and you don't believe that that's an appropriate thing to do, why do you have these big photographs of your religious leaders? And it's kind of difficult for people to explain that. So it's one of these things where there's one foot in a kind of, orthodoxy of practice, and there's another foot in, let's not say there's 3 feet, but there are 2 feet, and the other foot is in a kind of lived reality of, yes, we do want to see our leaders, and we do want their presence, and we do feel that this does us some sort of spiritual good to have the images of our leaders kind of watching over us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this kind of, pull back and forth. There are certainly some Murids, some people in Bamba's movement that are less comfortable with the image, and then other people, the majority of Murids, feel no difficulty whatsoever.
If you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you would like to see some of the art that we're talking about, you can go to the Krannert Art Museum and see this exhibition, A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. It is now open and will be there through the end of the year. So at any point, you can stop by at the museum and see it. Our guest here this morning, Dr. Alan Roberts, will be giving a talk on this subject that we're talking about here this morning, this afternoon at 4:30. That's at the Krannert Art Museum, and this is in the Talk in the Millercom series. They're always free and open to the public, and anybody who would like to attend, you should certainly feel welcome to stop by. And there also is a book that you have written,
yes,
that shows, I think, everything that's in the exhibition is there, plus also more material. So if people can't get to see it, they can go out and look for the book. And I think actually the title of the book is A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban,
yes,
Senegal.
Yes, and it's available at the Krannert. They have a little shop at the Krannert and Amazon or wherever.
Yeah, wherever you get your books. Our guest, Alan Roberts, is professor in the Department of World Arts and Cultures at UCLA, where he's also director of the African Studies Center. And here, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Amadou Bamba had one disciple.
Hmm.
A man named Ibrahim Fall, and there is also one photograph of him,
right,
which is also in the same way, also has been reproduced, and that's also another image that you will see. Sometimes there are places where you see the images of the two men sort of side by side, and he's part of the same stream and yet is another sort of within that stream. He and his followers have maybe some slightly different kinds of practices.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But maybe you could talk about how, you know, now Amadou Bamba died in 1927, and although he, I guess, had living descendants, immediate
still
descendants,
does.
And still does. Mm-hmm. How it is that Sheikh Bamba and his followers, how you see them as part of contemporary life in Senegal, very much a part of contemporary life.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about the early movement is that the gentleman that you mentioned, Sheikh Ibrahim Fall, was Bamba's first and most fervent follower, and really it was he, more than Bamba himself, who formed the movement and created the Murids. But then his own particular followers, as you say, constitute kind of an inner group in some ways, because one of the important messages that Bamba taught was that work is sacred, that it's a difficult place to make a living in Senegal because the soil is very poor and there aren't very many evident natural resources, and people really have to kind of work very, very hard against the climate. There's drought and famine and locusts and just all the different things that you hear about. So Bamba said that, you know, the most important work that any human being has is to provide for his and her own family. If even to the extent that you have to work instead of praying because the extra work that you would be able to do would make the difference in feeding your family, work, because work itself is sacred. It's a form of prayer. So Sheikh Ibrahim Fall really took that message and developed it in particular ways. And the followers that he has, who are called Bifal, have as their kind of active philosophy work itself. They work. This is how they are devoted. They, in fact, work on public projects, so building mosques and caring for the fields of religious leaders in one thing or another. And one of the things about them is that their joy in life is working. So someone who is their leader has the responsibility to tell them when to stop because they will work themselves to exhaustion. So there's a whole thing about just the sense of being devoted by working hard for a common cause and sharing the results and having a kind of solidarity that Sheikh Ibrahim Fall represents. His followers can often be picked out of a crowd in Senegal. There are some wonderful images of them in the exhibition because they often wear patchwork clothing. And the patchwork is quite similar in concept to our own quilting traditions here in the Midwest, for instance, where in the 19th century our great-grandmothers would set aside snippets of cloth that weren't necessary for making the dress or whatever, or would cut out the parts of a pair of pants that weren't worn out, the sides, if the seat and the knees were worn out, they would cut out the sides of the legs because that cloth was still good, and set it aside and use it in a quilt. And then when the quilt was put together, the people making the quilt plus the people using the quilt to wrap up on a cold night would recognize parts of the quilt and say, oh, you know, that was Aunt Sadie's dress that she used to wear when I sat on her lap when I was a kid. So it's that using a quilt is like wrapping yourselves in memories. This is true of this patchwork clothing for the Bifal, because they go around and get the remains from tailors that are making clothing and the little snippets, and then they sew them together. So as they assemble these very, very beautiful, truly remarkable pieces of, you know, kind of worn art, textile art, it's also a message about the solidarity, the community coming together and them wearing pieces of the clothing that are worn as whole dresses or robes by everybody else in the community. So they see themselves as working for the common good. What's interesting is, as you said, there's one photograph of Sheikh Ibrahim. He is dressed in black, or at least dark clothing in the black and white photograph. Bamba is dressed in white. And so often they're counterposed, because, and people will tell you just very explicitly, that's because the white of Bamba is the color of grace and intellect and the kind of teaching and thought that goes into being an instructed person and learning more about your way in life. The dark clothing is work, and so you always have to have the two combined, work and intellect. To the extent that there's a conversion community of Murids, people in the United States and elsewhere in the world who are not Senegalese by birth, who weren't necessarily born into Muslim families, that have chosen this path. And a friend of mine is an artist on the West Coast, a man named Chuck Abraham, who made a kind of yin-yang of Bamba and Lamphal, and the white of Bamba is then against the other half of the yin-yang symbol, because there is this kind of dialectic. You can't live by work. You can't live by intellect. You have to have them joined. Mm-hmm. So this kind of balance between these two figures is what really makes the economy of Senegal work. Mm-hmm.
I realize that it's difficult whenever we do something like this, where we're talking about a topic that is essentially visual, and we're doing this as a radio program. It's kind of difficult. So again, I would really suggest for people, if they can, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, that they go to the museum and they see the work. But I'm interested because this some of the work is representational, and so that will be maybe different from some other arts that you will see in other Islamic cultures. But some of it, like what you will see in other Islamic cultures, does use Arabic script, Arabic calligraphy. And I was really particularly impressed by the work of one artist in particular, Yelimane Fall, who, I don't, is this man a descendant of?
No.
So
no,
it's just like being named Smith, kind of, is that a common name?
Well, Fall is a very, very common name, and actually then has ethnic references and whatever, but he's an amazing guy. There are a number of his works in the exhibition, and as you said before, he is going to be coming to the university. The Center for African Studies and the Cranert have been able to find means to bring him in early December for a kind of workshop, and I think probably he'll be doing family day student kinds of activities as well. He was trained in graphic arts and has just the most remarkable sense of kind of, you know, graphic aesthetic. So his posters and his other work are just truly striking. But then the thing, as you say, that he really excels at is calligraphy, so the beauty of writing. Murids and Sufis in general are first and foremost Muslims. They have the same beliefs and loves as any other Muslims. And so the power of writing is just very, very significant. And this, again, is something that's shared between mystical Muslims and mystical Jews. If someone knows about the Kabbalah, for instance, and the power of letters and writing in the Hebrew script, it's very similar, actually. The script is different and the people are different historically, but the sense of God's word as expressed in letters and phrases and sentences and all that, and the ways that then words and letters can lead to numbers, so there's a whole science of numerology that's a kind of hidden sense of writing. That's something that Eliman Fall and other people absolutely excel at. So when he makes these great calligraphic works, and there's a couple of paintings that he did that are about something, say, like 8 feet by 10 feet or something, all calligraphy. He has made his own calligraphic script. He's invented his own script that he says was necessary because people in Senegal have to work so hard. And so he needed a script that would work as hard as the people do. And he needed letters that had bodies that could do the work that people have to do when they're in their fields or when they're just doing whatever else they do in life. So there's a very kind of active, animate sense to the letters that you'll see. They really seem to have a kind of motion implicit to them. And he'll tell you all about that. I mean, when he comes here, he's a very, very articulate person. He'll tell you all sorts of things about what the letters are doing and why he puts them together the ways he does. The two huge paintings that are on paper that I mentioned are an interesting example of how this exhibition kind of developed. Because from the start, my wife and I, Mary Nuta Roberts and I, were working with artists, and we specifically told them what we would like to do for the exhibition, but said that, you know, this is an exhibition through which we would like you to decide what you want to show and tell about yourselves to audiences in the United States. And so right from the start, the idea was that they would direct us to the sorts of things that they wanted people to know and how they wanted people to know those things and all that. So we were working with Eliman Fall, and we were telling him what we were doing, and we left Senegal that year and came back the next year. And he said, you know, I was thinking about what you're doing. You've got all these small things in the exhibition. You need something big. So, and here they are. And he had made these huge, very complex works that are absolutely astounding. Mm-hmm. And here, this is what you need. And we, of course, said, yes, boy, that's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah, they're really just knock you right out when you see them, but both in terms of their design and of their aesthetic sensibility and the way that they were executed, it's just really remarkable. I think that's the thing that when I walked around yesterday and took a look at some of the stuff, would impress me the most. His alphabet.
Yeah.
Very, 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 very striking. And each, what you've done is he's done each letter in the same size. They're individually framed. They're all on a wall together in this very dramatic black, white, and red colors. And if you go up real close to them, you see that they're actually cut out in very precisely and kind of layered up. And it's just, You just want to sit there and look at them.
And when you think that the way that he did that was, first of all, he had a sense of what would be the framed image with the letter in the center, and then each of the 28 letters, the Arabic alphabet has 28 letters. Amadou Bamba wrote a very important poem called Jawartu that has 28 lines. Each line starts with a letter of the alphabet. So Eliman takes those letters, and the other surrounding features are references from the poem or things that he thinks about in a mystical way, the numbers that are related between this letter and other letters, things like that. But then when you think, so he conceived of each of those in his mind, but then he executed it, as you say, by cutting out the letters with a single-edged razor blade out of a sort of plasticized paper in three different colors and superimpose them. Unbelievable. Yeah. Just truly a miraculous kind of event that you can see, because this is a person who is trained but doesn't have all, you know, it doesn't have the various kinds of technologies at his disposition that somebody would have in a studio here at, you know, the U of I that was wanting to make something that could look something like that. He doesn't have all those things. So he conceived it, he realized it with just a single-edged razor blade.
Well, it's just, it's really stunning. It's beautifully made. And as I say, it's stunning when you just see it, but then when you go, when I went up real close and looked at it and realized how it was made, I was
amazing.
Even more stunning, amazing. So again, at the Crown and Heart Museum, this will be there through the end of the year. A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. So definitely go and see it. Our guest here this morning is Alan Roberts, professor in the Department of World Arts and Cultures at UCLA. He's also director of the African Studies Center. And we have about 10 minutes left in the show. And if anybody who is listening would like to call in here and be a part of the conversation, you can do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for coming by and talking to us here. Really enjoying the show. I had a few, maybe a little clarifications that I think just needed to be a little clearer. In mainstream Islam, there, I'd say probably the Sunnis, which are the majority, don't really have what we would call saints or imams that they would place pictures of them as a sort of protection that might be used, let's say, by a Sufi or a Shia Muslim. So I think the more of the art that you're talking about is probably more Sufism and more of a mystical Islam. Mm-hmm. And you kind of mentioned something about that. All Muslims have a very similar, you know, approach to art and stuff like that. So I thought maybe that would kind of clarify it a little bit, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to?
Yeah. Thank you. It's true that, you know, people have different approaches to art, and so the differences that do exist within Islam between Sunnis and Shiites, and then Sufis who can either be Sunni or Shiite, you know, each individual, each group can have its own approach. One of the things that one could say about the Sunnis, however, is that as there's a kind of sense that you learn the practices and the kind of devotional beliefs of Islam through the Sunni Islam or any other kind of Islam, the fact is that there's a sense of envisioning your own spiritual leader. So if you're looking to a particular holy person for the kinds of guidance in life and the sermons and the explanations of holy text and all that, there is a sense among Sunnis as well as other people that one should have in one's mind a sense of what the spiritual guide looks like. And this is a kind of sense of, you know, a sort of interior visuality that then is realized in some places more readily than others. So there certainly are these distinctions, but the fact is that the Murids, the people in Senegal, are in fact Sunni. So, you know, there are these kind of variations. There's a universalist Islam. All Muslims are Muslims, and that's where things can begin and end. But then there is this kind of local practice that is also significant. So different places have developed ideas differently. You can see this in, for instance, the music and dance that's associated with certain Muslim practices. In Pakistan, for instance, the qawwali, the singing that goes on, which is a Sufi practice, is different from what Sufis would be doing in Senegal, but also similar in some very interesting ways.
Well, it strikes me that this is something, and I know because I've read some comments you've made various places where the art has been shown, that seems to be is an important point you want to get across, that particularly by the popular media, maybe recently, we've been presented with one kind of view of mm-hmm. Islam
right.
It that makes it seem monolithic.
Right.
And I think the point you're trying to make is, well, you know, there's not just one Islam, right. and that if you want to get a sense of it, you know, we're talking about a lot of different people, a lot of cultural backgrounds, mm-hmm. people living different places in the world. While they may indeed have some basic sort of beliefs that they hold in common, in fact, there are going to be significant differences in practice. So it's not just one thing.
That's right. And, you know, for people who aren't so familiar with Islam, then the example of Catholicism is one that could be drawn as a comparison because, you know, the Vatican and the sort of central messages are there for all Catholics. But then Catholic practice is very different in southern Mexico from what it would be in Peoria. You know, there's just these different ways that people realize the divine messages. So this is true of Islam as well, and there are then just different ways of being that are both addressing the universal opportunities and blessings of Islam, but then are very, very local. So, you know, there's a kind of tension between universality and locality that is true of Islam in the same way it is of any other religion.
Well, within Senegal today, how many people would identify themselves as Mourids? Or I don't know if they would use that kind of terminology. Perhaps they would say, well, we revere Sheikh Bamba, then maybe they would say. I don't know what they would say.
Senegal is an interesting place. It has been recognized, actually, by the U.S. government for its religious tolerance. The majority population is certainly Muslim, but there are also Christians and people practicing traditional African religions. Of the Muslims, the Mourids actually are not probably the largest Sufi movement. There's another one called the Tijaniyya that probably has more people that follow that. But there's a lot of overlap because the people in the different movements respect the histories and leaders of each other's practices and often kind of participate in a common way. So there's just a lot of people that certainly do say that they're Mourid, or even if they don't say they're Mourid, they still might certainly respect what the Mourids are doing. The Mourids are found the world over. There's many, many Mourids now in any American city. The Krannert had a wonderful opening for this exhibition that drew over 1,200 people to the opening celebration, but also drew over 60 Senegalese who came down from Chicago that had been approached by Dana Rush and her students here at the U of I and invited down. And so there's a real identification with Mouridism, but then there are other people that would say, well, I'm not a Mourid, but, you know, their devotion to work is something that I really admire, and I'm like that as well.
Mm-hmm. How did you become interested in this whole subject?
I've been working in and on Africa for a very long time, literally over 40 years. And I was in Senegal in the mid-90s for something else. I was working on an exhibition that concerned recycling. And I hadn't worked in Senegal before, and I noticed these images that were so intriguing precisely because I couldn't figure out what the heck was going on. It was just a very unusual kind of image to see all over the place because, as I said before, it really, and as you said, if you see the image, you can't actually know what you're looking at because it's so obscure. And so I was wondering what that was. And so literally the next trip I took back for this recycling exhibition, I brought my art historian spouse along, and we got hooked, and now we're 12 years into it.
And you're an anthropologist?
I'm trained as an anthropologist, yes.
So now that you mentioned it, we have a couple of minutes left, but I'm really curious about your interest in recycling.
Yeah.
You mean that it, you know, essentially it means taking the stuff
right.
that people have thrown away and
yes.
then making something that you can
yeah.
use
mm-hmm.
out of it.
Yeah, and so it's not the same sense of recycling that we have here in the States where, you know, paper or motor oil or whatever gets put into a kind of collectivity that gets broken down into its essential parts. It's more that people will take trash and figure out something clever to do with it. Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting as an intellectual opportunity in that kind of recycling is that it's a great way to really sort of consider what constitutes creativity. And so one of the points of the exhibition was to go to a number of different places. I was the curator for the two African cases. One was Senegal, the other was the Republic of Benin. and to just see what it means to have a good idea. And so in Senegal, the people that we were talking to said, I had this good idea and I'm selling things that get people's attention, but it's that the hand of Sheikh Amadou Bamba led me to do this. And so they're very self-effacing. They don't take credit for being the big hero of the big idea. It's that I've been blessed by, the saint giving me the idea that means that I'm selling something and therefore I'm able to provide for my family. Yeah. So it really gets at the nature of what it means to be creative and productive and living a good life so that the saint will, in fact, help you out. Because if you're not a good person, you're not going to have good ideas.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting. I will suggest to folks, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you at some point here, now between now and the end of the year, stop by the Cranet Art Museum and see the show that we've been talking about, A Saint in the City, Sufi Arts of Urban Senegal. And if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Alan Roberts, he'll be talking about this work as a Millercom presentation. It's this afternoon at 4:30 at the Cranet Art Museum. Anyone who is interested should stop on by. Our guest is a professor in the Department of World Arts and Culture and is also director of African Studies Center at UCLA. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
We certainly appreciate it.